I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, it's Midday at the Movies with Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. After a slump in 2017, movies bounced back at the box office, besting the record set 2 years ago. Global ticket sales topped $40 billion last year in a world where streaming services are multiplying as quickly as movies in the Fast and Furious franchise. But a third of that increased revenue came from just 10 films. What does that portend for the future of flicks? Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews The Panties, The Partner, and The Prophet, a world premiere of a new comedy at the Shakespeare Theater Company in Washington. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome. It's Midday, and it's Midday at the Movies, the 116th Congress of the United States of America being sworn in as we speak up in Washington, down in Washington, I suppose, since we're here in Baltimore. We'll be talking a little bit more about that later in the week and next week. Lots of goings on in Washington, but today we are going to concentrate on movies as we do on the first Thursday of every month, except for when we feel like doing something else. And as always, my guest is Jed Dietz, the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. And Hornaday has the day off. Jed Dietz, not only the founder of the Maryland Film Festival, but considered one of the great interpreters of the music of Barry Manilow. I think a lot of people don't often associate with Jed, but I'm here to tell you. It's good to see you, sir. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Same to you.
And we'll be having you sing I Write the Songs a little bit later in the broadcast.
I'm glad you named a title. I didn't even know what.
Well, you're a little rusty, maybe. You haven't played the club circuit in a while, right. But it'll all come back. It's like riding a bike.
Yeah.
Folks, if you have things that, for example, are on your short list for the Oscars, the short list, or some of the things that are being considered have been announced, but the actual nominations are yet to be announced. And next month here on Midday at the Movies, we're going to talk about Oscar picks and stuff. But Jed, a movie that you had at the film festival, Charm City by Marilyn Ness,
yes,
which is a documentary about Baltimore, is on that short list, or on the list that certainly is in the running. Huh?
Yeah. So the documentaries go through this process where they do announce a small group, 15 to 16 usually. I didn't count this year, but it's usually something in that, out of which the final five nominees will be chosen. But it's a real honor to be on that list. And
yeah,
it's a particularly strong year for documentaries. We'll talk about it a little bit as it impacted the box office too.
Yeah.
But so it's a real tribute to her. This is her first. She's produced really good documentaries. This is the first one, I think, is directing. Maybe second is directing, but she's new to this and has done a wonderful job on this film.
Yeah, so good for her. So listeners, if you have things that are on your short list for movies that should be considered for the Oscars, give us a call at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can also send us a tweet @midday@WYPR. So you mentioned the box office.
Yep.
Things have really turned around since 2017. Yep. 2017, it was a particularly rotten year. And of course, there was all sorts of people sounding the death knell of movies in theaters. Everything was going to be streaming. It was all just, you know, people weren't going to ever leave their couch. And
right.
That didn't happen in 2018.
No, and these death knells have been announced pretty regularly since World War II,
yeah,
where it peaked. We had 90 million tickets sold in 1946. And that's the peak year by far in movie going. 68% of Americans were going to movies every week in 1946. But the truth is it slid coming off of World War II. Movie attendance in movie theaters slid pretty straight line down to the 60s. And from the 60s to this day, it's grown on a pretty straight line. It bounces, oddly enough, depending on the quality of the movies.
Yeah, who'd have thunk it?
Right.
And if the movies are good, it matters. Oh, gosh, let me write that down.
Right.
I got to remember that.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, this new force of streaming, mostly led by Amazon and Netflix, but Hulu and Disney's getting in, et cetera, et cetera. HBO has got a streaming service of their own now. You know, I think it's not clear whether that is a negative force or a positive force. The theater owners generally are worrying and think it's a negative force, but we are seeing examples. You know, we've seen several already this year at the Parkway of things where we're playing with streaming while they're on streaming services. And we've, you know, one of them, Mandy, we've talked a little bit about it in previous shows, has been a terrific hit for us. So, I mean, I think it's not at all clear where that's going. And then I think,
although there does seem to be some evidence to say that if you are a person who tends to stream movies, you are also a person who tends to go to movies. So the deal is, if you're a movie lover, you're going to seek them out either in your home or on your laptop or on your watch or wherever, you know, and you're also going to go to the theaters.
The evidence for that seems to be building, and I think it makes sense. We've had a little bit of history of that with this concern about piracy, which is a real issue around the world, but the most pirated movie is also the highest grossing movie in history. So as annoying and as costly as piracy is to all the, you know, shareholders of that movie, actors who ever have residual rights in the movie.
What movie are they? I'm assuming it's Love Actually.
I know you would have assumed Love Actually.
That's the only movie I like.
You're going to be very disappointed if I don't. That's not the highest grossing film in history.
Curses foiled again.
It was Avatar. You know, so the question is,
so more people are stealing Avatar and more people are watching Avatar.
Yes.
Yeah.
Paying to see it.
Yeah.
So the question is in fact the piracy some sort of bizarre word of mouth campaign that the studios hate, of course, because they don't get any revenue from it. But of course, they themselves give away movies in preview screenings to get word of mouth going. So maybe it is some sort of bizarre word of mouth campaign going on in the piracy, and that may be true in the streaming services too.
Yeah, and Netflix, which is, you know, as you mentioned, with Amazon, you know, one of the big studios, they produced 70 movies this year. 70. That's a lot of movies.
They have the single largest production budget last several years of any studio on the planet. And you just have to think, I mean, House of Cards, which was, of course, all shot in our area, and it's now done, but was all shot here for six batches. I was going to say seasons, but batches. That was the first thing they produced. They had bought some things, but so they, you know, 7 years ago, they weren't even in the business. And now they're the biggest, by dollar production budgets, they're the biggest.
And they revolutionized the way that consumers can think about watching series or movies on television, because House of Cards was the first series to dump all of the episodes at the same time.
Correct.
So HBO at the time, and they still do it, you know, if you're watching a series, you're watching The Deuce, you know, David Simon's thing, you got to wait each week for the next episode, right? House of Cards, you know, at that time, it was revolutionary. Now Amazon does it, now plenty of other people do it. But the whole notion that you could give people the ending on the same day that you're giving them the beginning was completely revolutionary.
Yeah, it was an amazing thing. When they were filming the first season here, they didn't know how to release it. There was a great debate going on between Media Rights Capital, which is one of the funders, and Netflix, which is the main distributor. The sole distributor was never planned to go into movie theaters or any other distribution. And the argument was, the conventional wisdom was the one you just described, which is you bring out episode by episode and it gets word of mouth going, and week by week the tension builds and blah, blah, blah. And The Wire, actually David Simon's famous series, five-year series, actually they saw that happen. They didn't plan it, but they saw it happen where they would see audiences build. It never had huge audiences on its first showing on HBO, but by the time they bring out the now quaint DVD sets,
right, they were little cigar box, yeah.
And they were noticing people were buying them up way out of proportion to the audience, and they were surprised, and they were wondering what was happening, and it was the first now what we call binge watching. People were wanted to see four or five episodes together and see some arc, which of course each season had an arc. And so as House of Cards was being shot, the big corporate discussion was, how do we do this? And when they announced that they were going to drop all of them at once on one day in February in the first batch, the trade papers went crazy. They said, these people are nuts. They're undercutting themselves. This will never work. And of course, it has been legendary
success. Of course, the only reason you could see it was to subscribe to Netflix. And if you're already a subscriber, what does it matter whether, of course, right now it just seems like so, it seems like a no-brainer. You know, but, Netflix has already, gotten the money from you to subscribe to the service. You can watch whatever you want in whatever order you want and whenever you want.
Well, the great fear was this thing, what cable, paid cable has always talked about, their great fear is churn. And what the great fear was for House of Cards is people would watch it and then unsubscribe. You know, you'd buy it for 1 month and then watch all the episodes and then unsubscribe. And in fact, the data that was released showed, you know, some huge percentage of their subscribers watching the whole thing in the first 10 days after it was dropped. And they were really worried that this, then they would all unsubscribe. And in fact, that didn't happen. Yeah. They hung in there. And that's the, so that they see it as a marketing tool to keep the subscribers, get new ones and keep the ones they had. And that's what's happened.
Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday at the Movies. If you'd like to chime in about movies you've seen in the theater or streamed in your home or wherever else you stream movies, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'd be grateful for that. It's @TomHall. WIPR. Let's talk about the international market, too, because the number that they're floating around these days is, according to the Associated Press, at least, is about $40 billion.
Right, yeah.
That's a lot of money. the Associated Press says this is propelled mostly by Chinese moviegoers. Saudi Arabia has declared itself, according to the AP, open for business for Hollywood. They haven't had theaters for 35 years.
They had one in the Aramco compound. And that's it. Now they have two or three or something.
Yeah, but they got a couple of movies. You can't imagine how many. But in the UK, best year in Britain since 1971 for movies. And when we talk about Netflix, that's the 70 movies. I mean, they produce 6,432,000 other things. You know, that's a rough estimate on my part. But when it comes to like the China market, we hear about China in particular just because there's so many people who live in China. Yeah. But like the big smash hit here, Crazy Rich Asians, as I understand it, first of all, they had a tough time getting an Asian distribution deal.
Yeah.
And then when it was available in China, it didn't do too well. What does that mean?
Well, China, like with all outside media, you know, they're really schizophrenic on, they're now dealing with the Western world. Obviously, they're a player, international player, in all form, I mean, business as well as entertainment. But it often gets coupled with trying to control things. They worry about the wrong message getting in. And Crazy Rich Asians had gone into the process, the studio had put it in the process of, you know, being distributed in China, and they wouldn't get responses from this commission that authorizes distribution, and they could not figure out why. And it turned out that there was just a notion that this picture of rich Chinese, which most of the Asians in the movie in Singapore are Chinese, and this was not liked by the Chinese authorities, and they, you know, it sort of went against.
So it was more the authorities than it was the movie viewing public.
Oh, it was totally about the authorities, mm-hmm. And once it got into China, it's become a big hit.
Mm-hmm. Star Wars was a bomb. There's another Star Wars coming out this year in 2019, Star Wars number 9, I think it is. All of the top 10 movies, every single one of them, were either a sequel, a reboot, or based on a comic book. What does that say? And we've talked about this with Anne before, too. You know, when it comes to original movies, you know, news stories, the top original movie was A Quiet Place, which is the horror movie, right? John Krasinski?
Yeah, and Emily Blunt,
his wife. And first time director in that case. What does that mean? That the ones that make the tons and tons and tons of money are, you know, in some way, shape, or form, rehashing things either from another medium or from another movie?
Well, I think it says two things. I mean, one is you can't ever really predict this. I mean, the big corporations who make movies, Disney and Paramount, et cetera, that's their job, is to try to figure out, you know, they're betting hundreds of millions of dollars and then half of that in marketing on top of the production costs. Their job is to, you know, make money. That's what they're trying to do. And they're, you know, having a brand like a comic book or something that they know. I mean, they study this. I mean, they do unbelievable polling all the way through before they've even started production. And they know core audience. They know what their numbers are as best they can. But the truth is, a movie clicks or it doesn't. It's like any piece of art with all the effort you put into it. And then some of these things take off and some of them don't. And I think the other thing that's happened is the studios are narrowing their focal point so that they spend the big bucks on things that potentially can be huge hits worldwide and let the other stuff go. And yet Sundance this year, the independent, you know, the best place to see independent, what's going on in the independent world, which is all the rest of movie making below the studio level, 14,000 submissions to Sundance this year.
A lot of people making movies.
And you can see in the numbers as attendance has gone up since the 60s, distribution has gone up. I mean, I think there were 800 movies brought out into movie theaters this year. 150, 170, something like that from the studios. All the rest of it was independent, and they're new distributors, including Netflix and Amazon.
Yeah. And of those 800 movies, I mean, I've seen estimates between 700 and 800 movies. However, it's a lot, right?
Yeah.
A third of the revenue comes from 10 of those movies.
Right.
You know, so it's a small chunk of movies that are making most of the money, and then there's everybody else making, in many cases, good art. And in some cases, really rotten art. I mean, that's the thing with Netflix. I mean, there's a lot of garbage on Netflix. I mean, God bless them, they're trying. And, you know, but there was a Saturday Night Live skit about this. There was a New Yorker spoof about it, you know, about they'll green light anything, you know. But, boy, oh, boy, just when it's that small a percentage of movies making most of the money, talk about the 1%, you know, it's something.
It's true, but I think the diversity that's come into the movies now, the fastest growing movie going population movie theaters now are Hispanics. The second fastest growing is African American. The third is Asians in North America. So, I mean, I think and it's a younger audience. So I think you're seeing a lot of diversity come into the audience, and that's coming from these smaller films to some degree. Obviously, Black Panther's drawing the kinds of numbers that all sorts of people are going to see it. But I think that the diversity of the movie making and therefore distribution and the marketing are the two factors that have really hit this.
Yeah, and the 2,000th fastest growing sector of the movie going public is Linnell and Me.
Well,
we don't go to a lot of movies. However, the ones we've picked lately have been really good, and we're going to talk about that when we come back. Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. It's Midday at the Movies. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And you can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday at the Movies. I'm Tom Hall here in Studio A with our good friend Jed Dietz. He's the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on Ethics. Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics will join me to talk about the explosive case of the Chinese researcher who announced just a few weeks ago that the birth of two twin girls happened at his doing. It's the first gene-edited human beings being born here on Earth. Now, of course, gene editing with humans is banned in most countries, including China. But Dr. Jeff Kahn was at the conference in Hong Kong in which this researcher discussed what he had done. The announcement of what he had accomplished had been released a couple of days before that conference began. So we'll get an update from Dr. Jeff Kahn on Midday on Ethics tomorrow. Also, I'm going to speak with the legendary classical pianist Leon Fleischer. He is 90 years old, and he is still playing concerts, including this weekend. He's got three jobs with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. That's all coming up tomorrow. It'd be great to talk to Leon Fleischer here on Midday. A little later today, theater critic Jaywin Russick has a review of a new play that's having its world premiere at the Washington Shakespeare Theater. And if you've just joined us, our good friend Jed Dietz joins me here in Studio A. As I mentioned, he is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. He has announced his upcoming retirement, and you are in a transition now. You've got an interim executive director, and you're looking for a permanent replacement. Huh? That's
indeed.
All moving on apace?
Moving on. Movies every day still.
There you go.
Yep.
I want to talk a little bit when it comes to this great box office news that the movie business has. By the way, I love that the National Organization of Theater Owners, NATO. The people who release it, NATO.
Right.
If only they would fund themselves a little more, aggressively. I think maybe President Trump would be in favor of it. But they announced, among other things, that there were four documentaries that each cleared $10 million. That's a lot of money for a documentary. So it's RBG, the Ruth Bader Ginsburg movie, and now there's a sort of fictional narrative biopic that's out about it. Three Identical Strangers, which is going to be aired on television on CNN.
Yes, CNN film.
Coming up at the end of this month. Won't You Be My Neighbor, the doc about Mr. Rogers. And then the other one called Free Solo, which we've talked about with you and Ann.
Yep.
So that's really extraordinary that four of them, I mean, usually there's maybe one or two that, poke their head out of the snow, but boy, that's an avalanche.
Well, and before Michael Moore, there weren't any that were released commercially to any extent. Frederick Wiseman, one of the great seminal, Pennebaker, you had a hard time even finding a documentary film in a movie theater. And this is really a sea change. And I think it's possible, actually two of those, you mentioned the Ruth Bader Ginsburg On the Basis of Sex, which is the fictional version with Felicity Jones, is just coming out. And I think it's possible the doc will outgross the narrative. And there's a narrative being made about Fred Rogers right now that's in post-production with Tom Hanks. Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm.
Mariel Heller directing. And, we'll see. But it's fascinating that these documentaries are doing as well. And we've seen it at the festival, too, where people are sort of passing by narratives to get to documentaries.
We got an email from Matt who says, speaking of Netflix, they now have a few series that come out on a weekly basis, and my wife and I won't even watch them. If we can't watch multiple episodes at once, we pass. That includes network television. If we know it's going to be on Netflix in 6 months, we just wait. I think Matt is not alone.
No,
and his wife are not alone. Now, of course, Netflix picked up millions of subscribers this year, and they had a bunch of successful movies that were successful both in theaters and on Netflix, one of which I just saw this weekend, and you and Ann have loved this movie for a long time. Ann thinks the director is the best director ever, and this is Roma.
Oh.
Right? So this is a movie that takes place in Mexico City in the 1970s, and it's kind of an homage to the director, what's his name?
Alfonso Cuarón,
mm-hmm. The nanny that he grew up with.
Yep.
And so we saw it at home. You've seen it. You saw it at the Senator Theater, right? This is an amazing movie.
It is an amazing movie. And you're right. Netflix went to Cuarón. This is a major director who won an Academy Award for Gravity, which also was a big commercial success. He directed one of the Harry Potter movies, The Prince of Azkaban. He started making small independent films. Y Tu Mama Tambien was one of his that started the Toronto Film Festival, but he was unheard of at that point. But they go to him as a major director, saying, what do you want to make? We're, hoping that he's going to say another space thing or another thing with George Clooney. And this is what's in him. He wants to make the story about the neighborhood Sur Roma in Mexico City, where he grew up. He has these memories as of a child. He was in sort of upper middle class family and was really taken care of by these two women, one of whom was sort of the main woman who took care of the whole family. And this parent, various things happened in the family. I don't want to give anything away. But he decided to go in and shoot this. And he went back to the neighborhood. He had to recreate many things. There had been an earthquake in the neighborhood. There had been, design changes, of course, all through the neighborhood. And he put this huge effort into it. And the thing that's so fascinating is Netflix, which brought it through the festival world. It was at Venice where it won awards, and then Toronto won awards, Telluride. and then went out into movie theaters. And they were going to put it in movie theaters on December 14th and then drop it on Netflix on the 21st. And their presumption was it would then disappear from the movie theaters. And movie theaters, you know, they said, this is your deal. You know, you're taking this thing, maybe you'll only get a week. Well, it is staying in movie theaters. We're opening at the Parkway tomorrow. And it's...
Right, so it's been at the Senator. Left the Senator. Now it's going to the Parkway. Yeah. And it's still, of course, on Netflix.
And it was in some of the movie theaters in D.C. never let it drop. They're still playing at Landmark E Street and stuff. And it is, I would say, see it wherever you can. But the sound design alone and the beauty of the 70-millimeter film that he shot it on.
It's a black and white film.
Oh, it's just gorgeous.
But it's almost not black and white. I mean, it's just, it's so, I mean, it is black and white. It's not a color film.
No, it's definitely black and white.
But it's gorgeous. I mean, there's a hue to it. There's a patina that's incredible. And these actors, and they're not even actors. I mean, as I understand it, the woman who plays the main role had never acted before. It's one of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
He gets this performance out of her that is just remarkable.
Yeah.
And the children are remarkable.
No, it's true. You're right on all counts. I mean, and there's some scenes in it. There's a very simple little scene where she's turning off the lights at night. And this was if you know anything about shooting a movie, it's the most complicated film. She comes downstairs and it's one shot. And she turns off these lights, so the lighting thing has to be. And, you know, I've heard him now talk about the difficulty of shooting that scene. And he shot it all in continuity. So you see it beginning to end.
Yeah, camera twirls around her as she walks around the house, turning the lights off at night.
Exactly. And it's such a beautiful scene. And you should go to see it in the movie theater. If you see it however you can see it, but for sure go to a movie theater.
But I mean, I do tend to look at movies in a somewhat technical way. But when I saw this shot panning around and she's going to all the different rooms, turning off lights, I thought this is a guy at the top of his game.
There's no question about it.
It was a little bit showing off too, and thank God because it was beautiful.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's just it's all through the child's point of view. He is, I mean, it's really autobiographical. It's Alfonso Cuarón's story. He's the older brother who's not a major character, but he obviously very much one of the kids in this movie. And his memory, I mean, he's talked about going back to these neighborhoods where he grew up in the 70s. And, of course, they're quite different now, still sort of hip neighborhoods. But things that he thought looked a certain way don't look that way, or maybe never did. And he went back and recreated tiles but the ambient sound that
it's gorgeous.
Is just incredible in the movie.
Another movie that I was very taken with, I saw it at the Parkway just a couple of days ago, called Shoplifters.
Oh.
It's a Japanese film.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I had read a little bit about it, and I thought we were going to see, we were thinking between If Beale Street Could Talk and Green Book and Shoplifters. And I said, you know, we haven't been to the Parkway in a little while. Let's go support the cause here.
There.
And this movie is remarkable, and talk about sound design and the way they shot it.
It's true.
Much of the movie takes place in a very small apartment that is populated by many, many people. And there's just stuff all over the place. The set is amazing.
Yeah.
And they're eating all the time. They're slurping in Japanese noodles all the time. And it's just the feel of this movie, that you feel the crampness, the tightness of all this humanity bashed into this one small living space. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it won the Palme d'Or at Cannes this year. It's the Japanese filmmaker Hirozako Koreeda has been making movies for a long time. He's one of the great legends in international filmmaking. And this is a movie, as you described, about a part of Tokyo that nobody from the West is ever going to see. It's poverty, but it's also about family values. And it's a family, I don't want to go into any details, because what this family is not what you think of as family, but reveals itself to you all through the movie. You learn things about, oh no, this person is not that relation that I thought it was, and all that stuff. And shoplifting is part of their sustenance, but there are jobs too. And the way that's all wound together is like a great mystery, and people taking care of each other. It's a sort of heartwarming film in this odd way, because they're living sort of a life of a criminal. and you learn more about that as the film goes on. But I agree with you. It's a wonderful film and been doing really well at the Parkway. Yeah. It's interesting with no marketing.
Yeah, and it's just, it's kind of unlike any movie I've ever seen. I mean, I really can't think of another movie that is even in the same ballpark. So I'm very happy to have seen that. This is a movie that I haven't seen yet, but we've heard a lot about it. And in fact, I think Terry Gross is going to be talking to the director, Adam McKay. Oh. And this is the sort of biopic about Dick Cheney. It's called Vice.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, I mean, first of all, Adam McKay totally fascinates me. This is not a trained filmmaker. You know, he was sort of Will Ferrell's partner, and
he was a writer for Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, and then he helped establish the Funny or Die channel that the two of them established. He directed Will in Anchorman. He did a very serious, fantastic movie called The Big Short about the financial crisis of 2008.
It's the Michael Lewis book.
Off the Michael Lewis book, which is, you know, full of all this unbelievably complicated financial stuff, which is sort of core to the movie. And he has this famous scene where, you know, Margot Robbie is introduced in a bubble bath to describe credit default swaps to us, you know. And that same audacity that I thought worked so well in the Big Short is used in Vice in a way that makes it really important.
So here we have a scene from Vice. This is Dick Cheney, who's played by Christian Bale, talking with the newly nominated Republican candidate for president, Mr. Bush, who's played by Sam Rockwell, and makes an interesting job offer.
I want you to be my VP. You're the solution to my problem.
I'm CEO of a large company. I have been Secretary of Defense. I have been in Chief of Staff. The Vice Presidency is mostly a symbolic job.
Right, right. I can see how that wouldn't be enticing to you.
However, the Vice Presidency is also defined by the President. And if we were to come to a different understanding.
Uh-huh. Go on. I'm listening.
I sense that you're a kinetic leader. You make decisions based on instinct.
I am. People always said that.
Yeah. Now, maybe I can handle some of the more mundane jobs, overseeing bureaucracy, managing military. Energy, foreign policy.
That sounds good.
Yeah, managing the mundane jobs. And you got to love the soundtrack. It's like outtakes from Peter and the Wolf. It's where you cue the timpani, boom, 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 boom.
Well, there's a little Jaws in there, too. Shark is circling.
The mundane jobs, energy, foreign policy, managing the bureaucracy.
Right.
I mean, this is really quite something, because these movies, I just saw LBJ the other night, as a matter of fact.
Woody Harrelson.
With Woody Harrelson. Yep. And that was a very good movie, too. And the portrayal of LBJ was, I thought, just spot on and incredible, just, you know, based on what I've read about him, and which is fairly substantial.
Well, the thing I would remind this Christian Bale, I mean, Sam Rockwell is really terrific in this movie, too, playing George W. Bush. But Christian Bale was American Psycho. He was the doctor, the great genius investor in The Big Short. And now he's playing this totally buttoned up control guy, Dick Cheney, shrewd control guy. And he is so good in this movie. He locks down on this character. And I think it makes it way beyond a biopic, because I think Adam McKay has looked for themes, and he's really looking at the entertainmentization of our politics and of our leaders. And Dick Cheney's the last guy you would think of is in that role, because he's so buttoned up. But you see how he plays into that, and now, you know, we have literally a guy from the entertainment world, reality television, as our president. You know, so I think this film is really an important film, and also highly entertaining and beautifully executed. And Adam McKay, just like he did with The Big Short and financial stuff, tries these outrageous things. There's a sort of faux Shakespeare moment in this, which I didn't actually think worked that well. But you got Amy Adams and Christian Bale doing this thing. And the fact that he tried this is so fantastic to me.
Yeah.
And he does it all through the movie.
Yeah. Risk-taking can either pay off or bomb, but it's fun to watch.
Yeah.
And a great cast. I mean, Christian Bale, Amy Adams, Steve Carell, Sam Rockwell, you know, so good bunch. There's a movie at the Charles based on a short story by James Baldwin, directed by Barry Jenkins, who did Moonlight, won the Oscar a couple years ago. If Beale Street Could Talk. This is another one that you've seen. I haven't, but I'm really looking forward
to
it.
Barry Jenkins is just a magician. I mean, he was here. We had a film of his in 2008 called Medicine for Melancholy, which I would urge everybody
to
rent. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he did the great Moonlight, and both of those were extraordinary. I would say Beale Street is a little less accomplished, and I don't know the book. I haven't read the James Baldwin book. I'm very familiar and a big fan of his essays. And I loved the documentary that Raoul Peck made on James Baldwin that was also at the Charles. Mm-hmm. But this one is it's beautifully acted. And it's a terrific story of its time. Of the three films of his, I don't rank it as high as those first two, but I think it's great.
We got a little clip. Again, the movie's called If Beale Street Could Talk. In this scene, Tish Rivers' mother is Sharon, and she's played by Regina King, and she's just heard a religious tirade talking about pregnancy and the child and the mother of Tish's lover. So here's a bit from If Beale Street Could Talk.
A child is coming. It's your grandchild. I don't understand you. It's your grandchild. What difference does it make how he gets here? The child ain't got nothing to do with that. Ain't none of us got nothing to do with that. That child. Get your shit. Take your shit with you.
Yeah, pretty intense stuff. Yeah.
And again, I think the diversity of the stories, and we've had Green Book, The Hate U Give came out this year. Both of those have done quite well. Beale Street for sure is in this category, where people of color are now making movies about people of color instead of, you know, well-intentioned white people in Hollywood making movies about people of color.
Yeah.
And it's a very positive thing in finding audiences.
Quick thing before we go, we're running out of time, but first of all, Disney and Warner Brothers are going to debut their own streaming services, right? So the field is going to get very, very crowded.
Right.
There was a thing called MoviePass, short-lived.
Yes.
It blew up, and it kind of tried to combine the subscription model with movies in theaters, like you pay a fee and then you can go to see any movie you want for
one a day
period of time. So that bombed, but Disney and Warner Brothers, who are they're not neophytes in this business, they must have done some research that says they even with Amazon and Netflix and Apple and Hulu and all that stuff, they can make a go of it. What do you think?
Well, and Disney just bought Fox, so their library has just expanded tremendously. And I think for Disney, unlike the Movie Pass business model, which I think never was a business model that made any sense. I think what Disney is saying, look, we've got the content. That's the core of this business. I mean, you can have the greatest delivery system in the world, but if you're not delivering something people want to see, go back to our early part of this hour, you can't make people see movies if people don't want to see those movies. And I think Disney says, we've got lots of movies people want to see. We got proof of that. Why are we just renting them to somebody else when we could establish our own channel? We'll see.
It would be like the car business in the 1930s, where there are 55 car makers, which, dwindled down to three, or maybe there'll be 100 streaming services in 2 years.
I think we're building into the 55 mode, and then for sure it will shake out.
Yeah.
But I would bet on Disney.
All right. Well, good to see you, sir, and we'll
Thank
see you,
you
next month. Appreciate it.
Great to see you.
Jed Dietz is the founding director of the Maryland Film Festival. Coming up, a review of a world premiere play in Washington. Jane Wynn Russick joins me on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1. WYPR.